Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. The congressionally mandated budget cuts called sequestration continue to have an impact on Wyoming. And while the state's Republican lawmakers say those cuts aren't having as big of an impact as predicted by Democrats, Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the delegation still isn't happy with the sequester.
Remember how the sky was supposed to fall because of sequestration? Well, those indiscriminate budget cuts that are ripping through just about every agency's budget in the federal government haven't been felt as deeply as many politicians promised. But Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says as the summer months roll on, they may rear their head yet again.
I'm sure as the weeks go on, we'll learn of more areas where there's been a genuine impact. Impact is not always viewed as something that has to be dealt with more federal funds. So thankfully, our culture is such that we adapt pretty well.
While the cuts aren't as bad in Wyoming as elsewhere, people are feeling them. Some physicians have volunteered for days off. Cheyenne's airport was able to stay open in spite of painful cuts. And national parks have less federal funds, but the state and the private sector were able to fill in some of the gaps. Lummis says sequestration is bringing out the Wyoming spirit.
When federal funds dry up or government funds dry up, we turn to each other in the private sector, your neighbors, to fill gaps. And fortunately, that's the culture of Wyoming.
Then there's the state's oil and gas revenue.
When they go to sequestering federal mineral royalties, that's $53 million. That's a lot of money in Wyoming, and we're concerned about it.
That's Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi. He and a bipartisan group of lawmakers from numerous western states say the federal government is abusing its authority. Enzi thinks the state has a strong case to recoup that money later, and he's still introduced legislation to cement the state's claim.
I've got a bill in that would allow the state to collect it and do whatever costs there are on their side, which would be true costs, and then send 50% to the federal government. And that way, what the federal government gets is considered revenue. What the federal government sends back to us is considered a tax expenditure and therefore subject to a sequester.
While Wyoming's Republicans like the budget savings from sequestration, all of them want to redirect those cuts to different personal and party priorities, the way Congress is supposed to legislate, methodically. There's a hang-up, though. The two parties are so far apart on tax policy that Republican and Democratic leaders in D.C. can't even agree to meet and talk about the budget and spending. Enzi says both sides of this political debate are being petty.
Both of them are asking for regular order and then denying it.
Enzi has been in the Senate since the 90s. In today's younger Senate, that makes him a veteran. His perennial complaint in this Congress is that there's no regular order. That's Washington speak for saying the legislative process is out of whack. Enzi says lawmakers in both parties need to roll up their sleeves and hold some tough negotiations. But currently, Republicans are blocking a formal budget conference committee from even forming. That's where leaders in the two chambers would designate appointees to work out major differences on spending priorities. And he says it's not that hard under the old way of doing things.
If it were done right, the chairman and the ranking member of the budget committee would sit down and work out some differences before they ever started and come up with a basic bill, which both sides could then amend if they could find people from the other side. Instead of making it contentious, it could be made agreeable, and then we'd come up with a budget that would be workable.
Currently, Republicans are blocking that formal budget conference because they're worried Democrats will try to hike taxes and increase the nation's debt ceiling as a part of any potential deal. Like Enzi, Lummis rejects the arguments of members of her own party on that point.
I'd love to see a budget become part of a debt ceiling deal, because then finally we'd have a roadmap that both parties agreed on in both houses going forward for the next 10 years.
Lummis says the current political climate in D.C. is pinching this economy until it screams.
The uncertainty in Washington has the entire country bogged down, whether it is local government, state government, private sector, investments that are on the sidelines, investments that are overseas on the sidelines. Our indecision may be the biggest obstacle to breaking the logjam in this economy.
So what can Wyoming's lawmakers do to convince their party leaders to put the politics aside?
I am nudging. I'm nudging on a whole bunch of different scenarios.
Nudging and all, Lummis still isn't very optimistic. Any grand bargain can come out of Washington in the near future.
My expectations are low for that kind of a deal.
So in the meantime, Wyoming officials are left with budget uncertainty. Wyoming residents are being increasingly inconvenienced, and in some cases, pinched really hard economically. And all the while, partisan gridlock continues to reign supreme in your nation's capital. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Last year, we reported on a new project to restore sage-grouse habitat that's been disturbed by energy development in the Powder River Basin. The Bureau of Land Management, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and other agencies are participating in the effort, and they're starting to make progress. We're joined now by Janelle Gonzalez, who's coordinating the project for the BLM, and Bill Ostheimer, a natural resource specialist at the BLM's office in Buffalo. Gonzalez says what they're trying to do is restore sage-grouse habitat after oil and gas wells are no longer in use.
Because we had such a large impact on so many acres in the Powder River Basin due to the coalbed methane natural gas development that occurred over about a 10-year period, we had approximately 21,000 wells that were drilled in the basin, and all the infrastructure that was related, there was a large impact on the habitats of sage-grouse and many other wildlife species. And so there was a concerted effort from different agencies and interests, federal agencies, state, NGOs, local groups that were interested in seeing what could be done to assist sage-grouse, primarily focusing on restoration of habitats.
And Bill, I wanted to turn to you for a moment because obviously oil and gas companies do have to do a certain amount of reclamation after they're done using a well. But what you guys are trying to do here goes above and beyond that. So can you talk a little bit about why sort of the typical amount of reclamation isn't good enough for sage-grouse? And what more do sage-grouse need?
Well, what the oil and gas, federal oil and gas requirements for reclamation entail is primarily and first and foremost stabilization of the system with the soils, getting something to be plant species to be reestablished to maintain soil integrity. And then the next step is to establish vegetation that is made up of native species and fits in with the natural area. In certain situations, that may be sufficient for sage-grouse to repopulate an area after development. However, some of the challenges we've got are reestablishing a shrub component in that system, whether that's sagebrush or kind of a surrogate shrub. Establishing that shrub component isn't something that's a regulatory requirement, yet that is a critical piece when it comes to what sage-grouse are looking for in their habitats. The other challenges or issues that we can see are not directly the well and the plugging of that well, but the accoutrements that come with it, the overhead power line that's needed to power that well, for example. You know, on federal surface, we can take that power line out, but when it comes to private surface federal mineral estate, which we've got a preponderance of in the Powder River Basin, we need to be working cooperatively with those landowners to try to restore those habitats back into a situation that's going to allow for those sage-grouse populations to become robust again. You know, our intent is, as we plug and abandon wells, at the same time, we want to be able to sew those habitats back up and seal those linear scars that come from the roads and the power lines and the pipelines. And the power has a little bit of a different issue in that, you know, a footprint of a power line doesn't impact vegetation so much with regard to where the poles go and things like that. But because of the unavailability of natural perches for sage-grouse predators like eagles, they will move to power lines to find places to hunt from. So that increases their ability to prey on sage-grouse.
Janelle, back to you. We reported on this project about a year ago, and at that point, you guys were sort of just getting started with it. How much progress have you made since then? How successful have you been at, you know, getting some of these roads or power lines removed, or getting more sagebrush and similar shrubs replanted?
A big part of this first year in the effort has been trying to seek partnerships. Because of our land status pattern here in the Powder River Basin, 72% of the surface is under private ownership, and then about 12% is managed by BLM and 8% by the state of Wyoming and 8% by the U.S. Forest Service. And so because of that, we could see that it was really important that we try to get the private landowners involved in what we're doing. So a lot of this first year, again, has been outreach to the different agencies and then to the private landowners. And then we've also managed to get a couple of projects done on the ground last summer. We were able to get some cheatgrass treatments accomplished on the ground, and we've got a couple more planned for this summer.
And as you mentioned, you're often dealing here with reclamation of areas that are on private property, and I can imagine that landowners may have come to rely on the roads and the power lines that the energy companies put in. So how receptive have landowners been to when you come and say, hey, we'd like to talk with you about removing these?
And that's all we can do is talk to them. But since last summer, too, we've hired a shared position. It's a position that's being shared between BLM and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or NRCS, and then the Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory. And that position is filled with a gentleman by the name of Brandon Elkins. And Brandon's been doing a lot of one-to-one outreach with landowners. He'll go out to their ranch and actually drive around with them, and he'll just bring up a number of these topics as they drive around, and just kind of giving landowners food for thought about, you know, specific roads and maybe questioning them a little bit further. Well, are you sure you want to keep that one? And we can certainly understand them wanting to keep some of the main roads because it helps with the overall ranch management. But we also have roads that just spur off that went to a well site. Well, you know, those are no longer needed. And to emphasize to these private landowners, too, that when the energy companies come to do reclamation, you know, they're probably going to be there, you know, for a short period of time, and you need to get as much infrastructure off the ground and get it done at that point in time, because they'll move on to the next ranch and very likely will not come back. So you kind of have only maybe one chance to get it right.
And Bill, back to you for a moment. How do you monitor something like this? How will you know whether these restoration efforts ultimately are successful?
Well, the ultimate answer to that is recovery of bird numbers into robust systems that are going to be self-supporting. So we have more assurances that we've got robust populations through time for successor generations. That takes time to get that. There's generally a time lag. There's a documented time lag associated with documenting impacts to the populations. It takes 3 to 5 years to actually see a decline in lek attendance after impacts to an area occur. So we're anticipating that we should see a time lag associated with restoration efforts as well, that it's not going to happen overnight. But we can track success through just numbers of wells that were taken out, miles of road, miles of overhead power, to determine whether or not we're on the right trajectory and things are looking the way we want them to go.
How long do you think it'll be before you'll be able to really see a difference?
I would hope that within the next year or two, we will be able to start to see some vegetative changes, positive vegetative changes with regard to the treatments that we've been doing for annual invasive grasses and the cheatgrass, that we'll start to see a better native understory in those sagebrush communities coming back. I would hope that within a decade, I'm hoping we'll be able to see bird numbers start to respond.
All right. Well, Janelle and Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your time.
Janelle Gonzalez and Bill Ostheimer are with the BLM office in Buffalo. They're working on a project to restore sage-grouse habitat in the Powder River Basin.
When we come back, we'll hear from a prisoner and the man he tried to murder. who have now become friends. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Willow Belden. Restorative justice is an approach to dealing with crime that puts the victim of the crime front and center and considers how the offense affected the community rather than looking at it as an isolated incident. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov has a three-part series about restorative justice efforts in Wyoming, starting with a case study.
Stephen Watt and Mark Farnham are best friends, but it's a friendship that came out of violent circumstances. I spoke to both of them at the Torrington Medium Correctional Institution, where Farnham is an inmate. In part one of the series, we'll hear how Watt and Farnham initially crossed paths.
I'm Representative Stephen Watt from Rock Springs, Wyoming.
My name is Mark Farnham. I'm an inmate at the Torrington Medium Security Institution, and I'm the man that shot Steve Watt 31 years ago.
March 18th, 1982. I was a Wyoming State Trooper, 26 years old.
For me, it starts a year or two earlier. I was going to college at the University of Minnesota, and I was selling cocaine, and I was using more than I was selling, and I got deeply in debt, and I just couldn't get out of debt, so I decided to come out to Wyoming to work in the oil fields to pay off the debts. The oil fields didn't work out very well. And one day, my rent was due, the tires are bald in the car, and there's no money. And everybody wants their money that I'd been owing for several years all at the same time. So I decided to go rob a bank.
On the 18th of March, I was assigned to attend a funeral for a Rock Springs City officer's son. And so as I dressed that morning, I decided not to wear my bulletproof vest, something I wore every single day.
So I robbed the bank. When I came out of the bank, I was surprised within 10 minutes they had the bank robbery on the AM radio. And I thought for sure I was going to be caught.
While I was having lunch, my dispatcher called and told me that there had been an armed robbery down in Craig, Colorado. She gave me a description of the man and told me that a man fitting that description had been seen around the Wyoming-Colorado state line driving a red sports car.
And I thought, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to get away because they had the wrong description of the wrong car.
And I went south of Rock Springs to look for this red sports car. And here come a little brown compact, and I decided to stop that vehicle and ask the man if he had seen this bank robber. And it turned out he was the bank robber.
As soon as he got behind me and turned on his lights, I stepped on the brakes immediately when I jumped out, and I shot twice at his head, shot him once in the eye, and the other bullet went to the side of his head. Then I walked up to the side of his car, and I emptied my gun into him, and he kicked out at me, and I turned around and left him for dead, and I went back to my car.
That's when I got out of my car and went to the front of my car and drew my gun. And my first bullet hit the little metal bar in the center of the headrest and ricocheted down and hit him in the left shoulder, which knocked him forward and to the right out of the way of the next five bullets, which would have hit him in the chest cavity. So my first bullet saved his life.
I'd been shot, and I didn't get far, probably about a mile.
3 miles, exactly.
Okay. So I wasn't going forward. My car was shot up. I'm not out running the police cars, and I'm out in the middle of the desert. So I got out, grabbed the money, and I started running across the desert with the gun in my hand and the money. And so by this time, a number of police agencies started showing up. And I laid in a little gully, wasn't very deep, probably 12 inches. And I looked down, and I had three bullets in my gun, and there was five officers in a semicircle out maybe 50 yards from me. And behind them, there was another 10 or 15 officers and more coming. And I said, this is not going to work. And I gave up at that point.
And an ambulance came and got me, of course. And so we ended up in the hospital right next to each other with just a curtain between us.
And they took me right to the jail as soon as they took the bullet out. And I went to jail.
They did 8 hours worth of surgery on me, sewing everything up, all the holes in my intestines and stomach, and cut out part of my liver and took my eye out. So the surgery was 8 hours. I was in intensive care for 3 days, a regular room for 5 days, and then they let me out. It took me about 2 months to get all completely healed up. Now I turned into an alcoholic, and I was taking painkillers, and I've become addicted to the painkillers too. The post-traumatic stress that I suffered from the shooting, I couldn't get past my hatred and my anger and my bitterness. and the nightmares were awful, and it just wore me out. And so I left the highway patrol and went to California and became a law enforcement chaplain out there. I'd become a Christian before I went to California. That whole time when I was struggling, drinking and painkillers and hating Mark, my wife said to me, "I don't know how long I can live in your hatred, Steve." She told me, "Why don't you forgive Mark?" And I said, "I have." And she told me I was a liar. And finally, I called the chaplain and I said, "What's wrong with me? How come I have no joy as a Christian?" And he said, "Well, why don't you forgive Mark?" And I said, "I did." And he called me a liar and I hung up on him. And a few days later, I called him back and he said, "Why don't you just write him a letter and tell him what's on your heart?" And I prayed about it, and I just put the pen to a piece of paper, and I wrote, I believe, what God wanted me to write. And the exact words in my letter, I'll never forget them, were, "Mark, I don't wish pain by sending these to you. I just want to share my joy with you. If you haven't already, won't you join me in Christ's love in the Christian family?" And I signed my name, and I shipped it off.
It was a big shock first. I was glad to hear from him. In fact, Steve will tell you, my first letter back was 17 pages long.
18.
Okay. So we started corresponding. We corresponded for 9 months. And
I had left California and come to Wyoming, and I was traveling around sharing my story in churches. Well, the Methodist minister called me up and said, "There's a Christian revival down in Rollins. Do you want to go? The guy that shot you will be there." I said, "Absolutely not. I'm not ready for this." And all of a sudden I went, "Oh man, I can't take this feeling. Yeah, I'll go." And it was like God lifted that weight off of me. And then we went into the prison, and I walked into the gymnasium, and the door opened on the other side, and the inmates walked in, and there was Mark.
I went up to shake his hand, and he gave me this big bear hug. And we talked for about an hour at that revival. And then after that, we continued to write, and I put Steve on my visiting list. And his kids grew up in the visiting room coming, seeing me. For a while, I was at the Honor Farm, and they would bring picnic baskets up there. And
they'd have barbecues.
Barbecues. And one of the strange things, I think, about this relationship is the normalcy. When he comes to spend time with me, or we write letters, or we talk on the phone, or we work on projects together, the first thing that we think about is not the shooting that day. We think about whatever's at hand at that moment, that project, that whatever we're working on.
Or the future.
Or the future, yeah. Love is absolutely at the center. Christ is at the center. Shared values, compassion.
Political views.
Oh, no. Steve is a little to the right of Genghis Khan for all you Republicans out there. And I'm a little to the left of Obama. So,
But yeah, I've gotten more out of this than probably I think Mark has.
When we come back, we'll continue Irina Joroff's series about restorative justice in Wyoming, and we'll ask whether the state's workplaces have gotten safer in the past year. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Joroff.
And I'm Willow Belden. We just heard from Stephen Watt and Mark Farnham about how they became unlikely friends after Farnham shot Watt over 30 years ago. Today, as friends, one of the things that bonds them is pushing for restorative justice practices within the criminal justice system. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff reports that for now, Wyoming has little to offer for those seeking restorative justice counseling in the state.
To start, what is restorative justice?
The underlying basis of restorative justice is to repair the harm that's been done in a crime.
That's Richard Prince, a trained facilitator in restorative justice.
It's not so much the issue that a law has been broken as it is that people have been hurt. And so what restorative justice seeks to do is repair the harm that has been done to the victim and also to the community that was involved in the crime.
Victims coordinator for the Wyoming Board of Parole, Randy LaSalu, adds that victims are a more central focus in restorative justice counseling.
In the regular criminal justice system, sometimes I see the victims just being put aside, and they're not really brought in as much as they should be or would like to be. I mean, it's their only time to really have a say.
The way it works is victim and offender are brought together for a one-time meeting to speak about the offense itself and their respective experiences after it. The victim has to request the meeting, and the facilitator does a lot of prep work to get both victim and offender ready to meet again. The state currently has no such programs for adults, just one for youth in Fremont County. But both LaSalu and Prince are working to bring more restorative justice counseling to the state. So far, LaSalu has done one session.
The outcome of the one last year was, like, ideal. They hugged. The offender told the victim, you know, what he was planning on doing, which was some really great things. And it was basically, you know, kind of what the victim was hoping for, that he had turned his life around and was moving towards the positive.
Prince says that for the victims, the meetings can also be an opportunity to get closure.
The victim may have a period of peace or a period of rest while the offender is in prison, but as soon as the offender gets released again, then the fear and everything rises back up because there was never any closure. The victims always have the questions, why did you do what you do? I don't understand. This is how you made me feel.
Prince has offenders benefit as well. He thinks it's important to salvage people who have done wrong instead of continuing to fill our prisons. The idea of salvaging is perhaps more poignantly told by Patty Grunland, a juvenile probation officer with Fremont County Youth Services.
This is a way that we can really divert juveniles out of the adult criminal court system.
Grunland uses restorative justice methods when dealing with youth who get into trouble. She thinks it's more effective than any traditional punitive methods.
The trend is they don't reoffend. They don't get tickets.
She works exclusively with youth who've committed misdemeanors, but there is similar data for all types of offenders and offenses. Grunland told about one of her first restorative justice sessions where she met with two young men and their neighbor who they had robbed. In that case, she says, the woman walked away after the meeting with her fear of the boys assuaged, and the boys were able to get a new perspective.
Because before it was just some old lady that lived next door. They didn't know her. And so for them, they could really identify that, well, this is like my grandma. This is like my family member. This is something that somebody could have done to my grandmother. They were able to share with the victim their apologies, their reasonings, their intent to make it right.
Still, Grunland says this methodology is not appropriate in every case, and Prince maintains that such efforts are in addition to the existing criminal justice system.
Prisons are going to be necessary. Jails are going to be necessary. The current justice system, the way we have it, it is necessary. Restorative justice is not to replace what we have. It's to work hand in hand with what we have. But at the same time, restorative justice is to bring out the people who we're throwing away in prison that we really shouldn't be throwing away.
In some states, restorative justice methods are used before sentencing, and eventually programs like that could help contain the swelling prison system, save money, and, in Prince's words, salvage more people. But for now, Wyoming is starting out small. LaSalu has received the go-ahead from the Board of Parole to develop the protocol for a victim-offender dialogue program and will attend a training in September. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
We now go back to Stephen Watt and Mark Farnham, who we heard from before. Farnham shot Watt more than 30 years ago, but the two later became friends. Since there are not any restorative justice programs for adults in Wyoming, they had to sort of improvise. Still, it seems to have worked out. In part three of our series, we'll hear what this self-led restorative justice therapy has meant for Watt and Farnham.
When Steve visits me, I get to see the socket where there's no eye. We never have whining sessions or complaint sessions, but things will come up in the course of a conversation like you would with any friend. For example, in the last 5 years, he's been through three operations, three or four, that are attributed to the shooting, and the state doesn't pay for it. And so he's about $120,000 to $150,000 in debt. So the shooting consequences are still going on. He's still undergoing PTSD. I mean, the slightest sound, smell, a police car, the slightest. Steve could tell you more often than I do, where he relives the shooting, and it's many times a day, and he's still going through it at night. And because I'm familiar with it or aware of it as the perpetrator, I can't see myself as the victim. I can't say, wow, I've done 30 years in prison. My life is gone. Because I get to see that he's in a prison. I get to see that he's spending his life now on crutches or in a wheelchair because of what I've done to him. I get to see the pain that he goes in. When we're talking, you'll see little things will come up. For example, he couldn't play football with his kids because of the bullet next to his spine. So he lost out on a lot of stuff. Recently he told me he was going to do some things like ride a four-wheeler because he didn't do it when his kids were younger. He was afraid of getting paralyzed because of the bullet that's still next to his spine. And so
I wouldn't trade places with Mark for anything. I can't believe how hard being my friend is for Mark. It's like Mark said, every time he sees me, he has to think about what he did to me. Because of that, every time he deals with someone else, he has to think of how I would do it. He has to stop, and if he's angry at somebody, think about how I forgave him. So it's hard. It's hard for me because just now when Mark was talking, the pain he's suffering from talking about it, it hurts me.
There's many stories with this friendship. It's 31 years. My father was a policeman for 16 years, and when I shot Steve, he couldn't deal with it. To a policeman, a cop shooter is the worst thing. It's absolutely the worst. And every letter I sent to him, he tore up. Every birthday card, every Christmas card, every Father's Day card for 5 years. People would ask him how your son is, and he said, I don't have a son. And Steve wrote him and said, if I can forgive him, why can't you? And my dad forgave me after that. And my dad's relationship and mine has never been better. The power of this story of his forgiveness, it just affects life after life after life for
and,
the good.
And now Mark's dad and I are good friends. And his sisters and I are good friends. And in fact, this summer, I'm going back and I'm going to meet his uncles and, his family back there. And I can't wait.
Whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, forgiveness is not about the person that you're forgiving. You're doing that for yourself.
Yeah.
And I can tell you about 1,000 instances over the years. Where I've made the decision to forgive somebody, whether it's a family member, whether it's an inmate, whether it's a staff member, and I just forgive them. Make the choice. When you forgive them, you can put you can go forward instead of looking back
and hanging on to that and staying in the same spot, because that's what you do. You're just staying in that one spot, and you can't move on until you do forgive. And so, whether you're a Christian or not, you have to forgive. And it's for you, not for that other person. They don't even have to know that you've forgiven them. So you got to forgive to move on. And restorative justice to me is for the offender to try to make their victim as whole as possible. Yes. And that's what restorative justice is. Is for the offender to make their victim whole, or society as whole as possible, to heal over those wounds, to do what they must do, you know, because there is a debt to pay. And the debt is to the victim and to society.
For me, there's a humanizing. It would really be easy in prison to get hardened, to get bitter, okay, especially during lengthy periods of time. But when you understand that you're responsible for the pain and you see that person and you have the empathy and the compassion, and I'm not saying everybody will or every perpetrator, but where the perpetrators can get that, there's a humanizing. And it, for me, I definitely have more empathy today for my fellow man than I did prior to coming to prison. Part of it is the pain of doing time. Doing time is painful. Part of it is, a big part of it is becoming a Christian. Part of it is seeing the pain that I brought into Steve's life. So for the perpetrator, I think there's a humanizing, and that's important. We don't want to send people out of prison that are callous, that are cold, that are calculating.
Watt and Farnham recently participated in a movie titled Unlikely Friends, a documentary about other similar cases of friendship between victims and perpetrators through forgiveness. Watt recently remarried. He wanted the ceremony held at the prison where Farnham resides so that Farnham could serve as best man. But the Department of Corrections denied his request.
Irina Zhorov put together this three-part series about restorative justice. You can hear her entire unedited interview with Stephen Watt and Mark Farnham at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Wyoming consistently has one of the highest rates of workplace fatalities in the country. Many of these are in the energy industry, though not all. Last year, the state legislature decided to tackle the problem by hiring more safety consultants for Wyoming's Occupational Health and Safety Administration, or OSHA. Most agree that the change has been positive, but some say more still needs to be done in order to reduce workplace injuries and deaths. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Safety consultations work like this. A company voluntarily invites OSHA to their workplace, and OSHA consultants go through and check whether everything meets safety regulations. If they find a problem, they work with the company to deal with it, but they don't issue violations or fines. St. John's Medical Center in Jackson has had several consultations over the past decade, and facilities director Jim Johnston says they've been helpful.
We looked at how we store our chemicals. We looked at some of our programs, such as, what kind of needles are you using? What kind of scalpels are you using? Do you have safety devices on those?
Johnston says OSHA has sometimes found minor problems. For example, they wanted documentation that the hospital was regularly checking equipment, and they wanted assurances that certain equipment is completely shut down when maintenance is done. Johnston says these were quick fixes, and he's grateful for the help the consultants provided.
Our employees are safer. Our patients are safer. Our productivity increases because we have a safe environment, and our accident rates decline over the past 3 years.
OSHA says those kinds of results are common after their consultants visit a site. Corinne Schubert has been a safety consultant for more than a decade. She says when companies invite OSHA to do a consultation, they tend to be cooperative about fixing safety problems.
We work any disagreements out, if there are any. In my 13 years, I haven't had any.
Schubert says the consultations are a win-win. Safety problems get fixed, and companies avoid fines that could come with serious accidents. But in the past, Wyoming had only 6 OSHA consultants, which meant that if a company requested a safety consultation, it could take 6 months before OSHA showed up. That's why the legislature voted to more than double the number of consultants last year. Wyoming OSHA Administrator John Eisbart says it's been a big improvement.
In 2011, they had done a total number of 109 consultations. In just the 7 months that we analyzed in 2012, they had done over 240. So the volume of consultations has increased dramatically, which is exactly what we want.
Wyoming's workplace fatality rate has dropped slightly in the past 2 years, but Eisbart says it always fluctuates, and it's too soon to tell whether this is related to the increase in safety consultations. Regardless, some say more needs to be done. Dan Neal with the Equality State Policy Center says in addition to more consultations, the state needs to do more on the enforcement side. He wants stricter penalties for companies that violate workplace safety rules.
Right now, the fines are at a level that for some of these businesses, you know, it appears to us that they might consider the fines that they get after an injury or fatality as a cost of doing business.
Neal says preventing workplace accidents is kind of like preventing drunk driving. If you don't enforce the laws strictly enough, people won't follow them.
When people started seeing that DUI laws were being enforced aggressively and people realized that, oh, this is going to cost me a lot of money, that's when I think we started seeing, you know, a real effort by people not to do this.
Neal says he also thinks OSHA needs more compliance inspectors. Those are the people who issue penalties for violations. Currently, the state only has 9 inspectors, and they only visit workplaces after there's been a major accident or a complaint. Representative Mary Throne, a Democrat from Cheyenne, agrees that tougher penalties are in order.
Obviously, you have to have carrots and sticks in the regulatory world.
Last year, Throne pushed for legislation that would have increased penalties for safety violations. But the bill failed, and Throne says she doesn't think lawmakers are becoming any more receptive to the idea. Still, Workforce Services Director Joan Evans says hiring additional consultants was the right way to start tackling the problem.
We need to be able to provide the resources for employers to get the help they need before we come in with a heavy hand and issue citations for things that folks did not even understand.
In addition to the consultations that OSHA offers, the Department of Workforce Services is hosting a workplace safety summit in Rock Springs next week. The event will include trainings on a variety of safety practices, as well as sessions on how best to recognize and deal with risks in the workplace. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll talk with Wyoming Public Radio's news director, Bob Beck, who just celebrated his 25th anniversary at the station. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. Wyoming Public Radio's news director, Bob Beck, has been with the station for 25 years this month. During that time, the station has received 81 national, regional, and state awards. Bob himself is a 2-time winner of Edward R. Murrow Awards and has contributed to 2 Emmy Award-winning television projects. He's covered the Wyoming legislature longer than any other broadcaster in the state, and he's helped WPR grow from being a small station covering southeast Wyoming to a nationally recognized operation covering the entire state. Bob joins us now to talk about his time at WPR. He says a lot has changed since he started there in 1988.
I think at the time there were maybe 5 of us who were full-timers, and then there was a number of students here, some part-time employees, and that was a theme for the first 3 or 4 years I was here. Everybody that worked for me was some sort of a student or an intern, and so we were, you know, almost a student training ground in some respects for the first few years I was here. I then acquired 2 full-time people, I think, 4 years later, and then that sort of changed things.
One of the other things that's changed, of course, is that we now have our own show, Open Spaces. How did that get started?
Well, we used to have a show called Wyoming Today, and it actually started as Wyoming Talks. It was a talk show at noon. We turned it into Wyoming Today, which was an evening show, but it was every day, and I wasn't satisfied with the quality of the programming. Sometimes you were talking to a lot of authors in a week just to fill the show, or you were talking maybe to the person who was building something in a community or something. You just ran out of good ideas. And so what I wanted to do was develop a high-quality news magazine program. And after years of begging to get the opportunity to do that, we put it together. My original thought was it would be a 30-minute program because I was terrified that we wouldn't be able to fill a whole hour. My news staff at the time said, that'll be easy, and we can fill an hour. And so that's what we've done. And that's been fairly successful. It's only 1 year not won a national award, and I've been delighted it's been so successful and people enjoy it.
What's one of the most difficult stories you've worked on?
Well, I think the there have been a couple, but I think the toughest one personally that I'll go to my grave thinking about was the Matthew Shepard murder for a number of reasons. I think, first off, it was, as far as a murder goes, a pretty bad one. There was a lot of violence involved in that. It's a little complicated. you know, why did he get in the car and end up on the fence, and what was the intentions of the people who killed him? I mean, that's going to be debated, I think, for a long time. So it's an interesting story in that regard. There was a lot of national media that came here that said a lot of things about Wyoming and Laramie, and there comes a point where you hear that, and you're covering the story, but you are part of the community, and so I think there's a stress that's involved with that, and just, you know, making sure that everything was accurate, and then knowing that we were reporting nationally as well. That's the toughest one. I was up a lot of late nights on that one, thinking about where I was going to go. It's also probably leads to one of my more amusing anecdotes that I could share. During all the madness of when this all started, it was homecoming week here at the university. And so to take a break from all the stress of covering that case, I actually took my normal duties where I work in the press box at the University of Wyoming football games, and I got a call from NPR. They had my number there, and they said, we need you to get the governor as soon as possible because he's calling for hate crime legislation. That was Governor Geringer. I happen to know Governor Geringer was not a fan of hate crime legislation, and I told them they were wrong. They said, no, we're right. It's on the wire. And I went and got Governor Geringer, who I knew was in the press box that day, brought him to the phone, had him tell the NPR editor that, no, in fact, he is not calling for hate crime legislation. And then I wrote the story, and they went, oh, okay. And so it was an odd, amusing part of a very stressful weekend.
You mentioned here with the Matthew Shepard coverage that you were juggling both your role as a reporter and being part of the community. And that sort of leads to a larger question. We usually think of journalists as trying to maintain some separation between their professional life and their friends, which is difficult in a place like Wyoming where you do get to know a lot of the people in your community. How have you juggled reporting on people who you might also be friends with?
I've always been very upfront with people that if we're golfing or if I'm doing something with them, do remember what I do. I have an ethical standard. I really will report on things that I know to be news. There are people I've reported on even recently that I know personally, and I just really focus on the task at hand. I'm sorry you got arrested for this, or I'm sorry that maybe you did this naughty thing, but I do have to report on that, and I'm not going to give you a break just because we know each other. You know, I really am here for the listeners, and nobody's going to trust me if I start cutting deals with people. So I've never had a big problem with doing that. Has it cost me an occasional friend? Yeah, it has. But, usually you get over that. And people it's like I like to say, I know a lot of police officers too, and I don't know many of them that are not going to arrest me for armed robbery if I commit that just because we have a relationship. And that's the same attitude I've taken towards people that might be in the news.
One of the things, of course, that you cover every year is the legislature. Give us some insight here into Wyoming legislators.
I would say the thing that I like to tell people about the legislature is they are all doing what they think is right. They are representing their constituents. So people in Northeast Wyoming do think quite a bit differently than those of us in Southeast Wyoming. And people in small town Wyoming think a lot differently than people who live in larger cities. In fact, that's really how the legislature is broken down. It's not necessarily partisan. It's not Republicans versus Democrats at all. It's generally where you live or what you do for a living. So all the oil and gas guys would like to see this happen. Those people who live in small communities would like to approach things this way. And that's usually where it's broken down. In fact, when I cover it, I cover the issue, and there have been times that I've gotten hammered by some of our listeners. You know, you had all Republicans in that story, but they all opposed each other.
So after all these years of covering the legislature, when are you running for office?
Yeah, that'll probably happen very soon. I've always joked that that is something that I would like to do just to get even for all these years of, I think there should be a media vote every year. So we have a chance because we certainly know the issues as well, and we should have an opportunity to pontificate. But then there's that little ethics thing that gets in the way sometime of a good time. But, I would love to consider that down the road, but still a little young yet for that.
News director Bob Beck is celebrating his 25th year at Wyoming Public Radio. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us all on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.